Thank you for joining us. I'm Julie Vecchio.
And I'm Brett Kelly.
And this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast and on Instagram at Fisheries Podcast as well. Support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast fan shop hosted by Teespring. You can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Look for the link in the show descriptions. Since the show's been on the air for over 2 years now, and we've got now over 100 episodes, we thought that we'd see what some of the folks who were guests on the show as students are currently up to. Because Brett and I were both student guests on the show, we thought we'd start with us. So, Brett, thanks for joining me today. You were a guest on episode 29 with some fellow Iowa State graduate students. Can you remind us what you were studying at the time your episode aired?
Yeah, sure. At Iowa State, as you said, I was getting my master's in fisheries biology, and my main project was focused on looking at stream fish populations in the cold water streams of northeastern Iowa. So the Iowa DNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service were particularly interested in wild trout sort of distribution and population status, if you will. So even though it was sort of branded as a stream fish project, I'd say the stakeholders were more interested in what native brook trout, you know, what their wild populations were looking like. And then brown trout have been introduced to northeastern Iowa as well, as with many other places across the world in the United States. So they're non-native, but they actually do quite well and they're self-sustaining in a lot of the area, but where Iowa at the time was a little bit behind, and not saying that as a slight, but you know, Wisconsin has just done so much work with trout because that just amount of streams that they have, and Minnesota had just published a really large distributional study looking at brook and brown trout, and they had done some competition studies with brook and brown trout as well. So, you know, Iowa was next in line to try and figure out what's going on with their streams. We did a lot of headwater backpack electrofishing, trying to get information on streams that are privately owned. So they probably don't have a lot of fisheries data, if any at all. Most of them probably had never been sampled before, especially since the majority of not only northeastern Iowa, but the entire state of Iowa is privately owned. So we did a lot of backpack electrofishing surveys, and basically just trying to look at the distribution of everything that we found. So everything from non-game species like dace and chubs, to the game species that the stakeholders were interested in trying to manage for, like brook trout and brown trout. I don't want to give anything too big away because, fingers crossed, I think we just got word back that my first chapter is going to be accepted with one more round of minor revisions. So that's awesome.
Nice. And then, congratulations.
And then the second chapter, we're going to, you know, try and find a home for it too. But just a couple of maybe key points. We found that brook trout distribution was pretty diminished across their native range in northeastern Iowa, which is pretty consistent with other areas where they're at the sort of edge of their range. So northeastern Iowa represents their southwestern tip of their native range. Trust me, I've done a lot of digging on this subject, and you know, the oldest literature that I can find documents them being native to northeastern Iowa and especially the upper Iowa watershed. So, and then conversely, brown trout seem to be doing quite well and have expanded their range, potentially might be having some sort of negative effects on some of the non-game species.
Ah, that sounds really great, especially doing those baseline surveys of areas that have literally never been surveyed before is really, really interesting and very important work. You know, kind of no matter what you're looking at, you want to know what's there so that if things change, you know what's happening, how that change is occurring, you know, what sort of things are going on. So you did finish your master's degree and graduated in the middle of the pandemic this summer. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I defended in June and...
But you finished, you have your degree, and you even got a job in the middle of a pandemic. Also, quite a feat. What is your current position?
Yeah, well, you kind of hit the nail on the head with that. But I currently work for Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission in the state of Idaho, working on steelhead habitat, sort of monitoring and restoration within the Potlatch River Basin, which is a tributary to the lower Clearwater River, which flows into the Snake. I started there on September 14th. I consider myself very fortunate to have landed it, because obviously there's tons of super qualified folks applying for a small pool of jobs. So
fabulous. Have you gotten to do any field work since you got there sort of late in the year up in the mountains where I understand it gets cold? I don't have much experience at the moment, but
yeah. So fortunately I have, I haven't been able to be a part of any of the restoration projects, but we did hear back recently that we are funded to implement another habitat project for next summer. So super excited. I'll get to be a part of that process next year. Primarily, a big portion of what I do here is sort of maintain, I'll say, a network of in-stream data monitors, like dissolved oxygen, in-stream flow, and temperature. Basically, we have those throughout the watershed that we work in so that we can try and, you know, look at some of those limiting habitat factors in places where steelhead, you know, need to either reproduce or have overwintering habitat, et cetera. I've, you know, gone out quite a bit, downloading data off of those loggers, installing new ones, and things like that. So I have gotten to see, you know, some really pretty places and volunteer on other people's projects. I've been able to do some Chinook red surveys in a different watershed, but it was pretty early on when my stuff was a little slow. And
fabulous. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. So since this is kind of a student and sort of after student show, do you have any advice for folks who might want to pursue a master's degree or a similar degree to yours, but are nervous or aren't really sure it's for them?
One of the things I try and sort of get across people is that you don't have to be sort of an expert in any one thing or know how to do everything that you're going to do throughout your project right when you start. And one big thing that I try and stress anyway, and other people might feel differently about this, is that I honestly feel like that there's some things that will be in your job description or maybe your project plan that you maybe don't know how to do, because at the end of the day, you want to do work that's satisfying whoever's funding the research or whatever, you know, your advisors want you to do. If you're a student, then you need to learn stuff as well. So if you go into a master's project knowing how to do everything, I think that you should be learning things as well and expanding your skill set.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. I'm 100% with you. Every time I've gone back to school and in fact, every time I've even gotten a new job, I've learned a ton of things and I've, you know, continued to develop my skills. And honestly, when I have developed those skills or when I've kind of feel like I've mastered the thing, then I'm like, okay, what's next? You know, I'm going to move on. Right. And I think I've actually even told this story on the show before, but when I got my master's degree, you kind of came into that program without a project. I ended up kind of between two projects. And one was using video to identify fish and, you know, quantify the numbers of fish that were in a particular region and that sort of thing. And it sounded pretty interesting because it was with reef fish and offshore and stuff like that. And the other one was a catch and release mortality project. Well, I thought about those two projects and I thought, well, I kind of already know how to like look at a fish and identify it, and I know how to watch TV. So I already know kind of what I would learn from doing this project. I know absolutely nothing about catching fish. So I think I should probably take on the fishing project because that one has more to learn. Well, totally. Of course, I pulled my hair out for 2 years trying to catch these stupid fish because I had to catch a certain number of fish. And then the next job that I got after that degree, I actually ended up running a program where we identified fish on video. But I picked up that skill anyway.
There you go. And see, now you have both of those skills.
Right, exactly. But definitely, I think that you should, you know, be open and ready to be learning as a student. And even as a professional, you should always be learning.
For sure.
So now I think it's time for us to turn our attention to several of the other folks who've talked to us while they were students. We have several folks who sent in updates. So let's find out what they're up to nowadays.
Hey, everybody. This is Drew Ransom, and I was interviewed way back in episode 15 talking about my research on tributary spawning lake whitefish in Green Bay. So since appearing on that episode, I graduated from my master's program and recently moved to northern Idaho to work as a fisheries biologist with Avista, a utility company based in Spokane, Washington, and the Idaho Department of Fish and Game to work on the Clark Fork River and Lake Ponderay watershed. So my primary job duties are to implement Appendices A and F5 of the Clark Fork River Settlement Agreement, and this went into effect in 1999. So this agreement is a very collaborative effort between Avista, Idaho Fish and Game, Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks, the U.S. Fish Wildlife Service, the Kalispell Tribe of Indians, and several others in order to mitigate the environmental effects that result from the continued operation of Noxon Rapids and Cabinet Gorge dams on the Clark Fork River. So the various settlement agreement stakeholders all handle different aspects of the settlement agreement, but my position focuses mainly on bull trout and west slope cutthroat reproduction in all the tributaries that connect directly to Lake Ponderay. So this involves a lot of backpack electrofishing in the summertime and red count surveys in the fall. So on top of that, my program also conducts boat electrofishing surveys on the mainstem Clark Fork River below Cabinet Gorge Dam to monitor general salmonid populations. So the primary species there would be rainbow trout, brown trout, bull trout, and west slope cutthroat, as well as mountain whitefish, actually. So I'm still in the whitefish game. We also perform nearshore gill netting in Lake Ponderay proper to assess all the adfluvial cutthroat populations. And I also coordinate an angler incentive program for introduced lake trout and walleye. So through this last program, anglers who fish on Lake Ponderay turn in heads of the lake trout and walleye that they have caught on the lake, and they turn it in for a monetary reward. And actually, through this program, Avista and Idaho Fish and Game have been very effective in combating these two piscivores. And some of the largest rainbow trout in the country are caught every year in the lake. Actually, they just had a tournament over Thanksgiving, and the top five fish in the rainbow division were between 23 and 27 pounds. So, and honestly, I've only been here since June, so not even 6 months yet. But this position has been very exciting. There's a lot of things happening. There's a lot of really cool work being done throughout the entire drainage. I feel pretty lucky to be kind of where I'm at right now. So yeah, that's an update for me. If anybody would like to contact me about anything or chat further, you can reach me at my Twitter handle, which is @AndrewRansom7. Or my email, which is andrew.ransom@idfg.idaho.gov. And remember, get outside.
Hey, Fisheries Podcast listeners. This is Renee Martin. I was interviewed on episode 28, where I talked about my research on deep sea lantern fishes and also the Sunday fish sketch. Since appearing on episode 28, I had the wonderful opportunity to work a 2019 summer fisheries position here in Kansas with your one and only host, Nick Kramer. I've also continued my PhD work on deep sea lanternfishes at the University of Kansas, publishing a paper on the evolution of heterodonty across the group, and I've been moving forward with my dissertation research. The Sunday Fish Sketch celebrated its fourth full year, and the artistic community that participates in the hashtag continues to grow. There's a lot of support to be found there for both new and practiced artists. If you're interested in contacting me to chat further, please find me at @lampickthese on Twitter or Instagram, or via my email, rpmartin@ku.edu.
Hey, fish folks. This is Travis Rame. I was interviewed on episode 17 about brown trout ecology in the Black Hills, talking about that in my master's research in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Since appearing on that episode, I've spent the last 2 years a suite of different projects in the Columbia and the Upper Columbia with the Spokane Tribe of Indians, from reservoir-wide krill projects to pike suppression, and then working as part of the Lake Roosevelt fisheries evaluation program, supervising that here with the tribe. I just recently accepted a job with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. We're going to be working with native salmonids, habitats, and recreational fisheries up in northwest Montana that I'm excited about. Recently, some of that work I talked about in the episode got published in the North American Journal of Fisheries Management, so check that out. If you have any interest in contacting me to chat further, you can find me. I'm about to be between email addresses again. So my personal address would probably work best at rehm.travis@gmail. Or you can find me, and I guess I'm going to try and get a little more active on Twitter, I guess. So at trrame, the handle there. So if any of you guys want to chat, I'd look forward to it. So thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone. This is Katie O'Reilly. I was interviewed on episode 18, talking a little about my research on Great Lakes coastal wetlands, but perhaps more notably about the annual science communication event I created called 25 Days of Fishmas. Since appearing on that episode in December of 2018, I am currently on my fifth year of 25 Days of Fishmas. If you haven't heard the episode, basically 25 Days of Fishmas is a Twitter campaign that's essentially an advent calendar of fishy facts. Back in 2016, I created 25 Days of Fishmas with the goal of really increasing awareness about the general awesomeness of Great Lakes fish species, since that's what I study as part of my PhD at the University of Notre Dame. Since then, 25 Days of Fishmas has really come into its own and has turned into an annual celebration of all things fishy. The campaign has since gone global with a bunch of other Twitter users featuring their own fish from a wide variety of different places, habitats, and counting some of the fossil 25 Days of Fishmases, a variety of time periods. This year in 2020, as I'm finishing up my PhD, I decided to switch things up a little bit from my normal Great Lakes fish focus. Since many people are unable to travel, I decided to take a bit of a fishmas road trip that would feature freshwater fish species from around the US. Doing 25 Days of Fishmas has really connected me with a lot of other people, including other scientists. But what I find even more rewarding is that it really facilitates conversations between scientists and non-scientists. Often these conversations are not, you know, typically easy subjects, things like climate change, habitat loss. But I found that the, you know, somewhat silly nature of 25 Days of Fishmas really gives an opening to start having some of those tougher conversations. If you're interested in contacting me to chat further, please find me on Twitter at Dr. Catfish with a K, or by email at KOREILL2@nd.edu. Thanks, and have a very Merry Fishmas.
Hi there, this is Hannah Harrison. I was interviewed on episode 36 talking about my research on the human dimensions of fish hatcheries and Great Lakes commercial fisheries. Since appearing on that episode, quite a lot has happened. I've been working with my co-hosts Emily D'Souza and Dr. Philip Loring to launch Coastal Roots Radio, which is a knowledge mobilization effort that's part of our overall Coastal Roots project. Since the beginning of COVID, we've been interviewing fishing folks all over North America and beyond in some cases to hear how small-scale fisheries are dealing with the impacts of the pandemic. We feature those interviews on our new podcast, Social Fish Tensing, because you gotta love a good fish pun. And at last count, we've conducted well over 120 interviews and produced over 18 episodes. Hosting this podcast over the past 9 months has been such an unexpected silver lining to the pandemic, and we are deeply grateful to everyone who has shared their stories with us. Our lab has also had a number of other cool updates this year, so I encourage anyone interested to check out our project website at www.coastalroots.org, which is R-O-U-T-E-S.org. If you'd like to hear the Social Fish Tensing podcast, you can find us on most streaming services by searching for Coastal Roots Radio. You can also find me on Twitter, and I love having new followers, so please check me out at Fish People Place. Thanks so much.
Hi, this is Noah Bressman. I was interviewed on episode 60 talking about my research on invasive amphibious fishes like snakeheads and walking catfish, as well as my scientific artwork and my crazy fishing experiences. Since appearing on that episode, I am now Dr. Noah Bressman. I passed my PhD defense back in April via Zoom, which was a nice and different experience where I had to do it to a nice crowd of images on a screen, but it was still successful. And since then, I started a postdoc in May at Chapman University with Dr. Doug Fudge studying hagfish slime. Currently, I am researching doing a research project for the Navy to figure out how hagfish slime could be used potentially to stop small boat propellers at high speeds, as well as researching other potential uses for hagfish slime. I'm also trying to understand the mechanics behind hagfish slime hydration, as well as how hagfish slime affects predators that try to eat hagfish. My artwork has stalled a little bit because I don't have access to the clearing and staining materials as regularly as I did pre-pandemic, but I'm still able to create some new pieces based on some of the images I already have, or making collages and rearranging the artwork that I already have into new pieces. But I was able to use this time to create a Fine Art America site where my artwork is now available in a variety of media, from everything from face masks to canvases, just as a way it's more accessible to people. But I'm definitely still keeping up with fishing. I do that almost every day, and it's keeping me sane during this pandemic, whether it's fishing in intertidal rocks, microfishing for the smallest things, or also surprisingly big things that come out of the little holes in the tide pool rocks, all the way up to kayak fishing tournaments for lingcod and everything in between. I've also had the great opportunity to produce a TED Ed educational animated video with the help of the TED Ed crew and amazing animator Anna Benner. And she helped put my research to life. And this whole video describes amphibious fishes, their adaptations and behaviors to allow them to survive on land. If you're interested in contacting me to hear more about what I'm doing, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Noah with Fish, or email me at noahbressman@gmail.com.
Hi, this is Lauren Flynn. I was interviewed for episode 77, where Nick and I discussed my master's research on Rio Grande cutthroat and non-native brown trout in New Mexico. Since appearing on that episode, I adopted a 4-year-old mutt named Rue, kind of like everybody else did. And I've also been hired for a permanent position with the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. So in August, Rue and I drove 4,000 miles from Las Cruces to Homer to begin my job as a refuge specialist. I am not sure what my job title means yet, honestly. But from what I can tell, I'm more of a generalist. I've been doing all sorts of stuff, including continuing on with the biosecurity project I started as a directorate fellow back in 2019. But I'm also learning all about kind of all these diverse land management issues around the refuge. I've also been learning how to administer special use permits, which is actually kind of interesting. And I've been taking some really cool trainings on Alaska Native relations. I'm really excited about those. We are currently planning for a COVID-safe 2021 field season for our refuge vessel, the Tekla, and I've got my fingers crossed to join the boat for field work next year. In other news, Nick might be excited to hear that I'm officially neighbors with the Kilchers, and Rue and I get to walk around their property almost every day, and it's so beautiful, and I'm just really grateful that I get to live here. Well, I'm all bundled up and hunkered down for my first Alaskan winter, and I'd like to wish everyone a Merry Fishmas. Take care.
Hello, this is Aaron Bunch. I was interviewed on episode 66 talking about, it was really mainly about the spring virtual meeting for canceled talks that I helped facilitate and moderate. And it turned out to be a really good meeting and a precursor to what turned out to be a really good virtual annual meeting that replaced what we would typically have in the fall for the American Fishery Society. I really appreciate the effort of Nick and all the other co-hosts of the Fisheries Podcast. And I'd really, one of the main things I'd like to do right now is acknowledge the fact that they have allowed myself and Dion Kerr and a couple of new co-hosts, Cassidy Miles and Leon Gua, to work with them and post the diversity and inclusion podcast for everyone to hear. This is huge. The Fisheries Podcast folks didn't have to do this, you know, but it really showed their dedication to the profession and really selflessness to allow us to jump on this platform that they've already created for over a year. From the diversity and inclusion podcasters to the fisheries podcasters, we really appreciate it very much. So since appearing on the episode that I spoke about a minute ago, I've started digging more into my PhD research, doing some range testing at Clemson University, where we're trying to get a handle on some really cool fine scale fish movements and how those movements are associated with the nature-like fishway on the Cape Fear in North Carolina. If you're interested in contacting me to chat further, you can email me at ajbunch@clemson.edu or find me on Facebook. I have several Facebook groups, Fish and Aquatic SciPubs, Fish and Aquatic SciStats. I appreciate the time and energy for this podcast, and everybody have a great day.
And you, Julie, you have somewhat recently, I can't remember, you know, exactly when, but earned your PhD from the University of Southern Florida. Can you refresh our listeners maybe on what your research was focused on?
Yeah, sure. So I defended my PhD in November of 2019. So only a few months before we stopped seeing anyone anymore, and officially graduated in the spring of 2020. Again, without a ceremony, I don't have a TAM, I don't have a hood. I'm kind of sad about that.
Yeah.
but maybe someday I'll just buy myself some regalia. At the University of South Florida in the College of Marine Science, my project focused on using the stable isotopes within the eye lenses of fish to reconstruct their diet and movement histories over their entire lifetime. So this is a very, very new field. Only a few other people in the world have published on it at all. Most of us know that you can age fish using their otoliths. Essentially, eye lenses are doing a very similar thing. They're laying down new layers of cells as the fish grows and as it gets bigger. And the chemistry of those cells is trapping the trophic and location information about the fish at that time. Those cells are not turning over, sort of like otoliths. And so you can go back and peel those eye lenses apart, use isotope ratio mass spectrometry to get the isotope information, and then use that to interpret what they've been doing and where they've been going over their whole lifetime.
That's way more techie than mine. And that sounds, that sounds amazing. Is that something that you had experience with before? Because I mean, for me, being in the stream fish world, truly, whenever you first describe your project, I had no idea that that was possible or people were doing that. Is that like a relatively new technique? Or can you speak to maybe the methods a little bit and like where that?
Yeah, it's totally new. I think stable isotopes have been a thing in marine and freshwater trophodynamic for seems like maybe 2-3 decades. People were kind of trying to get these records out of otoliths, but one of the problems with otoliths is that there is only a lot of carbon, right? Because they're carbonate and there's not a lot of other types of isotopes within them. And so it was actually pretty hard to get other types of information. Carbon and nitrogen give you two really good records of different types of things. And then also sulfur, which there isn't a lot of in otoliths. So anyway, otoliths are primarily a carbon structure. And so people were starting to look around for other structures that might give you more different isotopes than just carbon. To my knowledge, there was basically two labs that started looking at eye lenses at the same time, less than 10 years ago, and found that this was something that you could get that type of information out of. It's a technique that's been used for also aging fish, especially the long-lived fish. You probably saw a few years ago in Science, there was a headline article that made the news and the rounds and everything that declared that Greenland sharks were 400 years old. Well, the way that they did that is they used the carbon-14 in the center of the eye lens.
Oh.
So they aged it using the radiocarbon from inside the island. So a similar application, but kind of looking at a different question.
Okay.
And they're starting to do that in more and more species that don't have good age marks within their otoliths. So things that might live in the tropics or the deep sea where there isn't a lot of really good seasonal change to get good striation within your otolith, you can use the carbon-14 within the eye lens in the center of the eye lens to figure out the age.
That is awesome.
Yeah. For me personally, no. I had no idea that this was even possible. In fact, a few years before I started my PhD, I taught high school science and I taught high school chemistry, and I was not a fan. And so jumping into a project where I ended up using a ton of chemistry was not something that I thought that I would do at all. Again, a skill that I did not possess when I started, but really developed over the course of doing this PhD. In fact, I didn't even know that stable isotope ecology was a thing. I had no idea that it even existed when I started this project. I've been living in the same town, St. Petersburg, for close to 15 years. And I decided, yeah, I think I really want to go back for a PhD. And I contacted the guy that ended up being my advisor. And I said, hey, you know, I really want to come back and I really want to do it full time. Will you have me? And he was like, sure. And then I said, you know, I really love this species, red grouper, and I really want to know what they're doing. And he said, you know, we're starting to do this eye lens thing. You can probably figure out what they're doing with that. And I said, great, let's do it. And that the rest is kind of history.
You just cannonballed off the diving board. Like, yeah, that totally. Sounds like an amazing idea. Well, it was. And now, post-graduation, I've seen via the social medias that you have published that work. Is that correct?
I have one chapter that's available now as a paper, a second one that is accepted but not released yet. And I'm just at the point of getting a third one out into review. So yeah, exciting.
That's awesome. How was that for you? I mean, I've asked people on this show before about the review process. I have seen some horror stories about reviewers kind of really giving non-constructive feedback. So far, I have had a positive experiences. What about you?
Yeah, so honestly, these two papers that have been accepted, I thought we were going to get a lot more pushback. In fact, the other papers that have been published on this topic, like I said, only like five or six other people in the world have even published on it, have gotten a lot of pushback. And I don't feel like I did. I've got some good constructive feedback, but generally people were positive and you know, believed that this could be a thing. And here we are.
Well, I remember when I was writing my thesis, I talked to you and I still have the screenshots just in case the text messages ever get deleted for some reason. But you gave me some pretty awesome advice about writing and how to, you know, go about maybe your order of operations for scientific journal article style writing. But any tips or advice for, you know, incoming students that maybe the idea of a proposal or a thesis and, you know, at the end of their time with that degree, the idea of, you know, publishing in a big journal is kind of intimidating?
Don't leave it to the last minute and try to do it all at once. Write every day for a short period if you can, and make yourself sit in your chair for however long is going to work for you, 45 minutes, half hour, something like that. Set your timer, put down all other distractions, and make yourself sit in that chair. And then anything that comes out is valid. Just let it go onto your screen. Don't try to edit and write at the same time. So just write and then later edit. Have specific spaces and times for each of those. And then I think maybe we were talking about the order. I was told by one of my fabulous committee members, Chris Stallings, that the best order to write a paper in would be get your figures and tables together, write your results based on what those figures and tables look like, then your methods, because then you know what methods you need to include, and then your discussion. Okay, what did we learn? And then go back to your intro, because that is your setup and you need to have all this other stuff before you can set it up. Now, of course, this is going to be a little different when you're looking at a proposal because you don't know what you've done yet. But again, I think just for proposal writing, don't be intimidated by the process. Just sit your butt in your chair, turn on your timer, and make yourself vomit out words until they come out on the screen. Go back and edit it later. Yeah, is it going to be crap? Yes, absolutely. It's going to be crap and you're going to have to make lots of edits. But that's fine. Now there's something there to edit.
I love that. One thing that I'm glad you said helped me was when you said, don't try and write and edit during the same. That really helped me. I would just get stuck in a rut of trying to revise the same sentence 50 times instead of just going on and flowing out with other ideas that I had in my head at the time. So that helped me out a lot. And then, you know, someone else said that it might take going outside for a day and like coming back to it with completely fresh eyes, like go out fishing or go hiking or something and just sort of get that nature reset and then try and revisit what you're trying to talk about.
Well, I think that writing really can only be an activity that you do a few hours a day. You can't expect to spend an entire day writing. You just can't.
I'm sure I drove my girlfriend crazy, but there'd be times during my thesis where, you know, I'd be completely removed from working. I'd be eating dinner or I'd be about to go to sleep or in the middle of a conversation. And a sentence would pop into my head and be like, I'm sorry, I gotta go. And I would go and I'd write that one sentence down and be like, that's great. I couldn't expect to sit down at my desk for 8 hours and think, yeah, I'm gonna get 8 solid hours of writing in today. It just never happened. So what about your current position? What are you up to now?
I currently work for the state of Florida at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And I work in a group that's called the Fishery Dependent Monitoring Group. And our overall mission is to monitor and track the recreational and commercial fisheries, primarily marine, throughout the entire state of Florida. My personal job has to do with a lot of the statistics and the data management, taking a lot of that recreational data and bringing it to stock assessment meetings, doing the statistics that we need in order to bring these massive, massive data sets on the fishers of Florida and what they're catching and what they're looking for to the decision-making and stock assessment process.
And so one thing I'd like to sort of leave out on is your opinion on going back to school after working sort of, you know, in the fishery science field or maybe even some other jobs here and there and having that gap in between your degrees. I know a lot of folks are hesitant to do this or even against the idea, but for you, it worked out really well. Can you maybe talk us through that experience?
Yeah, I still remember in undergrad being told that I was crazy for not going straight to grad school and that if I didn't go now, I would never go. People just get used to making a salary and so they never go back. And that has not been my experience at all. I took extended breaks between both my bachelor's and master's and between my master's and my PhD. Between my bachelor's and master's, I worked in outdoor education for over 4 years. And then enrolled in a master's degree program. After my master's degree program, I worked in fisheries for 6 years. And then I started teaching high school. I taught high school for 3 years. And I really just realized while I was teaching high school that I really, really wanted to do a PhD project, that was just something that I needed for my own self. And so again, there was a 9-year total gap in between my master's and my PhD. Yes, there is a pay cut when you're a graduate student, but on the other hand, I do feel like a lot of the skills that I learned being out in the world and working were things that I could apply to my degree. I knew how to do a lot of the types of things that a lot of grad students need to learn while they're doing their PhD. And so I think that, you know, that experience in the world really helped me to work extremely efficiently as a PhD student and to really keep things in perspective. I would encourage anyone who wanted to go back at any age, because I think no matter what, you have things to give and you have, especially at somewhat older ages, you have a lot of perspective to add to your degree.
Thank you everyone for listening to this 101st episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of either of us, you can find us on Twitter at fishvecchio or at bbk_95. The podcast is at Fisheries Pod on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or shoot us an old-fashioned email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, it's never too late to go back to school, and you don't have to be the perfect ideal candidate with all the skills that you need to learn while you're in school.